right, we welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals. We only have one case on our 9 o'clock docket, and I see you all are ready. Lock and Green versus Murtaugh et al. If the clerk will please announce who will be arguing. All right, and Mr. Ferris, you have a handout, which I believe you've already provided everybody. All right, and opposing counsel has theirs, correct? All right, thank you, Mr. Ferris.
May it please the court. This case is about the future and whether or not the appellees will have to live by the same rules and contribute their fair share just like the other property owners in the subdivision. By its summary judgment, the trial court ruled they do not. The appellees argue four reasons why they are exempt from following the same rules: latches, waiver, limitations, and that they are excused by things third parties did after the covenants were filed of record and before the appellees acquired their property. I'm going to spend most of my time on two of those defenses because I think the other two can be kind of drop-kicked into the corner in a hurry. One is the latches defense. That's an easy one to deal with. There's no proof of extraordinary circumstances. There's no proof of change of position. This is not an equitable case, but a case involving a legal remedy, and there is an applicable statute of limitations. We acknowledge that the four-year statute applies. We say the cause was not barred by the running of limitations. The waiver defense is equally as weak. As this court said in the Musgrove opinion, to establish a waiver of covenants of this sort, the violations must be so great as to lead the mind of the average person to reasonably conclude the covenants have been abandoned. That's just simply not the facts of this case.
Well, was there any evidence either way that dues and fees were paid through those years?
Your Honor, I looked through the record, read the entire record, and I do not recall any proof of that. And I don't believe there was, whether they were assessed or whether they were paid. Okay. Limitations, the four-year statute of limitations does apply. The appellees are correct in that. But the association's claims in this case were the association's claims against the appellees in this case were not time barred. The association sued for two things. One was to end a recent violation that was painting the curbs. This isn't the pig in the backyard case, the pet pig that's been there for more than 4 years. This was a rather sudden thing. They also sought declaratory relief that the appellees were subject to the recorded covenants. The appellees cite the Gerst case and a number of other cases. Those cases, I think, can all be distinguished. They all involve a trailer house or a pet pig or some long-lasting violation of a restriction that was simply ignored and was apparent. This case is different in that what we're really talking about here is dollars and cents. Can the appellees be obliged to help fix that dam should it ever need to be repaired or to meet some other future assessments or even future dues requirements of the association? And I say that's a different case. It's more analogous to the installment payment line of cases. The handout I gave you, the first several cases, and if you're the strange way that thing was done, I was going to read from it, and I thought you all don't need me to read to you. But each of those cases, each of the cases involve something that's a little bit different from just an installment loan case, for instance. I mean, in the Supreme Court opinion in the Universal Life and Association, Universal Life and Accident versus Shaw case involved the weekly payments under an insurance policy. The Solar Soccer Club case involved the continuing violation by the lessee of the use clause in the lease. The Dvorkin opinion out of this court would involve the continuing obligation to develop the land. And we just think that the statute of limitations did not run on any future obligations. Now, if the association should go to the appellee's opposing counsel's clients and say, by the way, we're going to have those assessments back more than 4 years ago, I think they'd have a very strong argument that limitations apply. I think that's what it's intended to cover.
So the suit was originally on this painting of the curb violation plus a deck action to state that these five or six homeowners were also within the association.
Yes, Your Honor.
And did you sue for back assessments?
No, that was not in the case.
Okay.
That was never brought up. But you know, that's the elephant in the room, and I can't ignore it. The fourth defense involves construction and actual notice. Chief Justice Livingston, your opinion in Aston Meadows discusses constructive notice as actual notice. In this case, we've got both constructive notice. All of these filings here in the deed records in Tarrant County that predate the appellees acquiring any of their property. And also we have actual notice. The appellees each signed a planned unit development rider. Those are appended to my supplemental brief. And those put them on actual notice that they had to cooperate with a homeowners association.
And those were documents that they signed at their own respective closings?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Each of them, when they closed, they had to sign a PUD rider.
Okay. And those riders were admitted into evidence in the trial court?
They are actually part of the deed records. Well, this was a summary judgment case, and
right.
They're actually a part of the summary judgment proof, the documents that are attached to the appellee's motion for summary judgment.
Okay.
But they were certainly before the court. The word "that" is a big concern. There's a reference in one of the documents cited by the appellees that says those people that become members of the homeowners association have certain obligations and responsibilities, and they seize upon the word "that" as saying, "Well, what about those that don't become members?" That one word, if you accept the appellee's understanding of its application and its definition of the agreement as a whole, dashes the rest of the document into a cocked hat. In interpreting a document, we're obliged to try to make it all make sense, and the appellee's seizure of the word "that" and trying to turn the case upon that is an invitation to chaos. And that's pretty, I think we've discussed that, I think, sufficiently in the brief. Standing is not an issue in this case. The appellee's, probably their argument, strongest argument may be on the fact that, well, there wasn't a homeowners association until years later. It was some subsequent person or entity that actually got around to creating the homeowners association, but there was always a need for one. There was always an obligation to create one. Finally, someone got around to doing it, and standing is not an issue that was raised in the appellee's pleadings or in their motion for summary judgment.
But doesn't the failure to even create the homeowners association when it was supposed to be created contribute to a waiver argument?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. That's a very good question, and I don't think it does because everybody took their property with constructive notice. There isn't a change of position. Well, that would be like a laches defense. There isn't an apparent open and obvious character to this. I mean, it's something that didn't happen until years later. But I don't believe it would constitute waiver. You threw me a hard ball, Judge. That's a very good question. but I think these covenants are terribly important, and I think that argument again is an invitation to chaos, because this could get what could happen. What happens if the dam fails, and what would be the right of the other homeowners association who entered into the agreement with the developer of this subdivision, and they have a right. They said, look, we're going to have these interlocking bodies of water. They've got to be maintained. The City of Arlington is a party to some of these documents that are filed creating covenants. The City of Arlington has a concern. So I think for that, for those, because of their interests, well, let's just put it this way. I think their interests, their concerns, weigh against waiver in this case. I did cite, on the handout I gave you, I did cite one additional case addressing the latches defense. That's the Dillard versus Broyles case. It has a quite an interesting discussion, and I recommend that to the court. And unless there are other questions, I have nothing further.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ferris.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Welch.
May it please the court. The first issue I would like to address is the idea that these my clients are being treated differently than the other homeowners. And the homeowners that I think are most relevant are the other homeowners that were actually in the same position as my client. There were additional defendants in this matter who were released on summary judgment, who bought their properties, who owned homes that were constructed prior to the homeowners association and the declaration that's at issue herein being filed. Those homeowners also filed a motion for summary judgment. They were also released. There's been no appeal of theirs. These are actually duplexes as they exist. And so those people actually own the other half of one of the halves of one of the duplexes my clients own. So we would be talking about now, he's asking that two parties of the same duplex be treated differently. There's the one party who's not going to pay homeowner association dues, who's not going to be a member because they've already been dismissed from this case without any appeal. And then there would be my clients who somehow should be a member of this HOA formed well after their homes were built. So I think that's the most important issue with the idea of people being treated the same. My clients should be treated like the other homeowners who were actually in their position. And this is a complicated case that involves lots of things that were recorded over a large period of time. And for that reason, I'm going to start kind of going back through what was recorded, how it was recorded, and how we end up here. The very first was the settlement agreement between Lock and Green and Coventry, who was going to be the initial developer of this property. They came in, they were apparently going to develop it. The neighboring homeowners association had concerns regarding that. As a result, there was a settlement agreement reached. Settlement agreement does provide that Coventry will set up an HOA and that some members of, that some people who buy in the lot will become members of that HOA. As far as the contract interpretation and the way we're reading it versus the way they're reading it and the word that, it is a rule of contract construction that all parts of it are to be giving their meaning. If it had been intended that each and every person who bought in that subdivision would become a member of the HOA, there would have been no need to put that become members of the HOA. It would have been assumed all purchasers were members of this mandatory HOA. That didn't happen, and that didn't exist. That's not the way it was written. I would imagine it wasn't written that way because Coventry hadn't built anything yet. They hadn't even begun development, and so they did have options with how the property would be developed.
And you're talking about the settlement agreement of 1982, is that correct?
1982, between, I believe it is Interlochen and then Coventry.
Okay.
And as Your Honor pointed out, no HOA was ever created pursuant to that agreement. In fact, Coventry never, to the best of anybody's knowledge, took any further steps to develop the property. They never built on the property. They never built any roads on the property. This was still vacant land at the time Coventry owned it. Coventry also entered into an agreement with the City of Arlington. The City of Arlington, they were going to privatize the roads, Coventry was, and they reached an agreement and said, City said, we'll let you privatize the roads in exchange for you being responsible for them. Thereafter, the entire thing was sold to a new developer, a Lock and Green joint venture, who records a revised final plat, who changes up the development. They also reach an agreement with the City of Arlington. And there's no mention of a homeowner association in any of the Lock and Green joint ventures agreements with the City of Arlington. Thereafter, in now 1986, the six lots that were the original subject of this lawsuit were sold. And when I say six lots, it's I represent five clients. There were also three people who were previously dismissed. That comprises the six lots. At that time, there were homes built upon at least a portion of the six lots. They were built without any restrictions. There were no restrictions in those deeds when the properties were sold. And it is on the record that actually the homes at issue in this case are different in appearance than the subsequent homes that were built by the developer. They're actually a different color. One of the restrictions in the restrictions seeking to be imposed here restricts what color the homes may be. And these six homes are difference in color, difference in appearance than the remaining subdivision that was built almost a decade later. After these six lots were built, it appears the Lock and Green joint venture went into bankruptcy. And so the whole remaining portion of this project went through a bankruptcy while these six lots had their homes built on them and were sitting there. So now, what plan for development there was at this point probably goes out the window because everything was subject to a bankruptcy and went through a bankruptcy. The lots passed through a bankruptcy proceeding. Thereafter, new developer comes on board.
Can you back up 1 second? Coventry sold to Lock and Green
joint venture.
Lock and Green joint venture, okay.
Who sold the six lots to Terra One Partnership, who built the homes that are in issue herein. Okay. Then Lock and Green joint venture went into bankruptcy and an entity named Bright Bank Savings Association purchased the remaining lots through the foreclosure process. Thereafter, the developer who subsequently did the 1993 declaration and built the rest of the homes now existing in the subdivision did purchase the land. And attached as Exhibit R in my original motion for summary judgment are letters from that developer as well as the documents that they had to have the homeowner sign because at this point the developer decides they want to privatize the streets and they want to take responsibility for the streets. But these were public roads and they were being maintained by the City of Arlington. So in order to get that permission, they had to have the owners of those six lots, those six homes, sign releases so that they could privatize the streets again and take responsibility for them. And that's part of the whole idea here of my clients should be forced to help out with this subdivision. Well, they had public roads that were maintained by the City of Arlington. And it was only after the subsequent developer came in and wanted to privatize things did the roads become private. And that was with my client's consent. The reason why, not my client's, but the previous owner's consent. In the letters from the developer say, we understand you're not required to join this homeowners association. We'd like you to join, but you don't have to. And if you don't want to join, what we would like is for at the very least for you to give us your permission for us to privatize the roads so that we can take care of them. And then I believe they also built a fence around the entire property, and so they asked for permission for that as well. Permission was granted by the six then homeowners. And then after a declaration was recorded, finally, by the, and you'll have to forgive me, the name escapes me. But in 1993, the developer who subsequently develops the property records the very first declaration, forming an HOA, putting in restrictions on this subdivision. And this is the most important thing about this entire case. In that declaration, the six lots, the homeowners I represent, and the other people who were already dismissed, those six lots are specifically excluded from that declaration. There is a provision in there that says this, the addition is defined, and the addition definition excludes those six lots. So thereafter, as far as the idea of constructive notice, actual notice, anybody who would have looked at the records in this case, looked at items in the chain of title, would have seen my clients were specifically excluded from any homeowners association or any restrictions from that declaration. They subsequently file an amended declaration by the developer, and then the Homeowners Association itself, after it has taken control, files an amended declaration And the HOA itself's amended declaration excludes our six homes.
Are you meaning excludes by doesn't list the numbers of the lots in the description of
Correct,
those?
It when it says the addition shall be described as lots 1 through, and I believe it's 26, it's like 1 through 25, and then it skips over, and then she'll include lots 32 and on.
Okay.
And that are all the things that were recorded, how they were recorded, and how we get to here. And that's part of a lot of defendants or a lot of plaintiffs' arguments depend on this idea that there was a common scheme or common development, plan of development as this went along. Well, clearly, there was no common scheme or plan. These things, the lots were sold. They were at the foreclosure. Six homes were built a decade prior to any other homes being built. So this was not one giant plan for how this property was developed. At the point where my six clients of the homes existed, the rest of the land could have gone any direction. It didn't necessarily have to be a homeowner association. It had gone through a bankruptcy, and somebody acquired it in that bankruptcy.
What is the first thing the homeowners association did that to treat these homeowners as members of the association?
They filed suit trying to compel their membership. That's the idea of this
so
parking
they recognized
dispute.
That they weren't members and tried to compel them to become members?
Correct.
And that was the first thing they did. They didn't demand any payments or...
No, there is the idea of this parking dispute.
But that's the first thing.
Council commented on the parking dispute. And here's the unfortunate part about the parking dispute that he hasn't brought to your attention is the parking dispute actually arose between the defendants who were already dismissed and are not being appealed and the Homeowners Association. Not the homeowners that are involved in this appeal. The idea of the parking dispute was one of those people. There were people parking in front of their house. They painted the curb. The Homeowners Association said, you can't paint the curb. And that is the parking dispute that arose. Had nothing to do with these homeowners who were involved in this action. And there's no mention of a parking dispute in their response to summary judgment. It is in their petition, this idea of a parking dispute. But again, it does not include, and my clients were never involved in any parking dispute. The only thing they're trying to compel of my clients is that they have joined this mandatory HOA, become dues-paying members of the HOA, and be bound by the restrictions imposed by the HOA.
But did the release the six homeowners sign to give the or to consent to the streets going back to the control of the developer, that related to the streets and curbs, though, correct?
Correct.
Was it a deed back to them, or was it an easement?
No, it was their permission.
Permission.
It was their permission. The city required the developer to get the permission of the homeowners to take it back and privatize it.
Okay.
Because they had public road service at that time. And so then we get to what are our affirmative defenses, and the first one being the statute of limitations. As the defense counsel now accepts, there is a 4-year statute of limitations with respect to imposing deed restrictions. One of the restrictions contained within the HOA's declaration is that all the homes must be a certain color and a certain design. Our homes do not meet that restriction. They've not met that restriction since before the HOA was formed. So the idea that the cause of action didn't exist when the HOA was formed quite frankly escapes me. The HOA clearly could look at the homes and tell they were a different color than what was contained in their restrictions. So that is a cause of action that's clearly existed for over 15 years. Again, the idea of the dues paying, they've never paid any dues. There's no evidence to them ever being asked to pay dues, and there's clearly none that they've ever paid them because the suit was brought seeking to compel them to pay membership dues. And so they've clearly not been paying the dues since at least 1993 when this HOA was set up. The previous homeowners didn't pay any dues. Nobody paid any dues. The three that have already been dismissed aren't going to pay dues in the future. These six homes are different than the rest of the subdivision.
No dues were demanded until the suit was filed.
To my knowledge, no dues have ever been demanded other than through the suit.
Can you speak to the riders that are attached to the reply brief of appellants?
Yes, and I would first point out that they were that's an issue first raised in the reply brief, not in appellant's brief. Secondly, those are an agreement between my clients and their lenders. And essentially, they are a way for the lenders to cover themselves. If you read the agreements, what it actually speaks to is that the lenders making sure the client, or my clients, won't violate anything if they have any requirements of their HOAs, so that it doesn't negatively impact the property, which the lender clearly has an interest in. So this rider is a CYA by the lender to make sure that if some restriction pops up, that their interest in the property doesn't receive some negative effect by an action of my clients. It was at no point of the lender's legal opinion that my clients were bound by it, simply that there is a restriction in the same area, and to cover themselves, they had my clients sign a rider. But at no point in there does it say what homeowners association my clients are going to be members of, that they're going to pay any dues, anything like that. It simply says my clients will comply with whatever is in existence. And there was nothing in existence. As far as the defense of latches.
Mr. Welch, your time is up.
Oh, thank
Sorry.
You.
Any other questions?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Welch. Mr. Ferris, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to make a couple of points. First of all, this is a deck action, and yet I'm not in here asking for rendition. I'm asking for remand. And the reason I think that was appropriate in this case was because many of the things the appellees have just argued are the sorts of things that sort of require remand, and that issues that weren't raised in the trial court, things that perhaps they can make some hay with on their next chance. One thing is they didn't raise the issue of the other defendants who were granted summary judgment from who and which no appeal was taken. They don't address whether that was that unfair treatment or would be a reason to grant summary judgment. Also, the color of the houses of the properties there. From what counsel just said, I gather they'd be time barred before you by the 4-year statute of limitations, because it sounds like they've all had this wrong color for more than 4 years, and I'll concede that. Suppose, if you will, if I'd like to make it an analogous situation, the discussion about these excluded lots. Suppose the original developer or any subsequent developer had decided, okay, I'm obliged to create a homeowners association, but I've sold lot 337B to my brother-in-law, and I'm going to provide in the declarations adding up the homeowners association that my brother-in-law doesn't have to be a member or pay dues. Could that trump the pre-recorded covenants? By the way, these covenants are not attacked as being ineffective. So I think that the bottom line has to be no. Some subsequent developer, even the original developer, once these covenants were entered, they have to live by them. In this case, there was an attempt in 1993 to do that. There's some language in there that I rather wish wasn't, not including all of the properties, but I think it was too late. I think that these covenants, with certain factual exceptions, almost are live in perpetuity, and I think they should in this case. With that in mind, we ask the court to reverse the judgment of the trial court granting the summary judgment and remand this case back to the trial court. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ferris. Thank you, Mr. Welch, and I believe Mr. Ross is with us today, too. We appreciate all of your briefing and your oral arguments today. Your case is now submitted, and we will adjourn court. Thank you.